Swear, I'm f***ed.
The following programming may contain content that some listeners find offensive. If you are sensitive to foul language or explicit content, please turn your radio the f*** off now.
We now bring you the following announcement. Generation Annihilation is now on the air.
All right, welcome to another edition of Generation Annihilation here on CITR 101.9 FM, streaming live over the World Wide Web, www.citr.ca. My name is Aaron, here till 1 o'clock, and we've got a very special show for you today. We've got a big interview which was conducted by myself and three scene veterans of the Toronto hardcore scene. Book just got released called Tomorrow is Too Late, and it's a ginormous book all about the Toronto scene. Spanning from the early 80s to, I guess, the late 80s, right into maybe a bit of the 90s. It's a huge, glossy, action-packed book with lots of flyers, photos. It's got a spotlight on special gigs, zines, radios. The pressing, which is now sold out, the first pressing, which is now sold out of 984 copies originally pressed. It's sold out, but that one came with a free record. And yeah, like I said, there's everything to do with the Toronto hardcore scene from 1980 to 1984. It's all in there with just a whole swack of stuff. And my experience with Toronto hardcore, yeah, when I got into hardcore punk at the age of 14, when I first started going to shows, I caught the tail end of a really cool scene of Vancouver hardcore, and things kind of were dying down then in the all-ages hardcore scene, but things seemed to really be still flourishing in Toronto at that time, and I used to write to I wrote to a handful of bands and fanzine editors and stuff like that, and they're going to get mentioned in this interview and covered in this show. So yeah, let's get into some tunes before we get into the interview. We're going to take you to a band who were quite notorious in the Toronto hardcore scene. I'm talking about BFG, also known as Bunch of Fucking Goofs. And actually, we started the show off with a track called Tomorrow is Too Late, which is the title of the book, Tomorrow is Too Late. And, yeah, it's by Direct Action, who were a very influential hardcore band. That was from their 1984 demo. So, yeah, a bunch of fucking goofs. And although I didn't notice this at first, but it crazy Steve Goof is on the front of the magazine, or in front of the book, the giant book, the giant tome known as Tomorrow is Too Late. He didn't have his mohawk then in that picture, so he was a little bit unrecognizable. But anyways, yeah, there was a spot. There was another thing I learned about Toronto hardcore, first hearing about it when I was getting into punk. There was some news documentary type things on. There was one on CBC, and they featured this band, Bunch of Fucking Goofs and Random Killing, who we're going to hear after. So yeah, let's get into it. Bunch of Fucking Goofs from There Is No Solution, There's No Problem. Double 7-inch is a track called Putting Us Down. Here we go.
Their whole fucking path. They sit back in their own little world, thinking of ways of putting us down. You can put us down, you're all fucking fools. Putting us down, soldiers are fucking tools. Fuckers who hate us don't know what to say. Thoughts in their hands are just hidden away. Keeping it in, cause we can't get enough. Fog our problems, is that enough? Putting us down only brings us up. Bring us up only puts you down. Bringing threats, renewal war. Genial masses and after some feedback.
All right, from the Something to Believe In compilation, that was Youth from Toronto, Ontario. That was also featured on a cassette compilation called Toronto Hardcore, and it was reissued on vinyl as well. And Youth, YYY, yeah, they were probably my favorite band from the Toronto area of that time. They had two awesome demos, and they had an excellent EP, mini LP called Sin, which came out on Fringe Records, which was partly run by Brian Taylor, who was a great help in collaborating a lot of the music and a lot of the stuff. He was interviewed tons for this book called The Toronto Is Too Late, and which we're gonna hear an interview of again. Anyways, let's not get sidetracked. Before that, we heard from Hype. It's All Hype was the name of the track. Name of the album is called Life Is Hard, Then You Die. Came out in 1984. And yeah, Hype made it out to Vancouver, British Columbia in 1987. Got to see them. And before that, in the set, we heard from Random Killing from the Take Our Flag release on Aardvark Records, going back to 1985. We heard a track called It's Okay, and yeah, Random Killing still going to this day. They formed like 83, 84, and from Bunch of Fucking Goofs, we heard a track called Putting Us Down. That's from the double 7-inch on Back Alley Records, and Bunch of Fucking Goofs had a big part in the Toronto scene. They had a venue called DMZ, and they had a lot of bands stay at their place, Fort Goof, and they are still going, I believe, in one form or another. Actually, it's been a while since they played, but so we are showcasing Toronto hardcore from the 80s on this edition of Generation Annihilation, and we're going to play an interview with three of the people involved in the Tomorrow Is Too Late hardcore book. Taking part in this interview is Simon Harvey from Ugly Pop Records, Sean Cherry, scene veteran, and Steve Perry, magnificent fellow who has hooked up lots the Generation Annihilation show with a lot of fine music from out that way. And he does the Equalizing Distort radio show. And let's get into this interview, shall we? Like I said, this took place on the phone at CIUT last week. Here we go. Enjoy. Hold on a second here. Just hold on a second. We're going to get into this interview momentarily, I promise. But first, we're going to hear a word from our sponsors. Here we go.
How do you listen to CITR? Do you stream it with your data? You could be getting it free on your phone with the already installed FM receiver chip, but major carriers have blocked access to it. If you want access to all your favorite CITR goodness on your phone, get involved. Visit freeradiomyphone.ca to see how you can get involved by contacting your carrier and signing our petition.
Co-authors of the book Tomorrow Is Too Late.
And I am Simon Harvey. I, too, am sort of one of those guys.
Yeah, it's been a while. This is going to be aired on Generation Annihilation. I remember you, Simon, a while back. Yeah, you were on. You lived out here. When was that? Mid-2000s, was it?
A long time ago, in a galaxy far, far away.
Yeah.
Galaxy where you can't step 5 feet without someone trying to sell you drugs or take change from you.
Yep. Know that all too well. So, Simon, and there's a third person involved in this project as well.
Yeah.
Tomorrow's Too Late.
Yeah, there was many of us involved, but it was Derek Emerson, myself, and Simon, and then even Steve Perry and a whole host of other characters were very much involved.
The main suspects were you, Simon, and just you and Simon, or?
No. Derek and Sean were the primary people. I was there mainly just to add a sort of glamorous edge to proceedings.
Oh, I see. Okay. And how did it all come together? Who came up with the idea for the book, Tomorrow's Too Late, shall we say, documentary or biography on Toronto hardcore? How would you say it?
We're calling it a visual and oral history of hardcore in the 80s. That's sort of our...
Yeah, you...
Which totally erases my writing.
Okay. So in the 80s, okay. So this the book is I've almost plowed through it all, but the book is dates from, would you say, like 1980 to what year, would you say?
Well, we said 80 to 89 just as as bookends, but really, you know, hardcore is not really starting until 81, like 82 really in Toronto.
Okay.
And then, you know, it probably went through, you know, phases of death and rebirth even within that period of the 80s. So some people would have said, you know, if you got into hardcore after 84, it was already dead. And other people would have said, it's, you know, for me, it started in 84. So.
And we also, you know, Poison Idea played here in 1990, June of 1990, which for many of us was a formative show. I mean, it was one of the best shows I've ever seen in my life. So we kind of shoehorned that in because, you know, who's going to tell us not to? It's our book.
Yeah, yeah. I've looked at the photos. They're pretty cool. Jerry A. all slashed in blood there. Did I just ask whose idea was it to come up with this project?
It was I think there was a bunch of us on various Facebook groups of, like, you know, MSI had a Facebook group, and, you know, Steve's been doing a great show and has been, you know, archiving and documenting the, you know, the punk scene here in Toronto forever. Simon's been re-releasing Toronto and other bands' records. There was great stuff done on 70s punk already. You know, there was, you know, Treat Me Like Dirt, Last Pogo Jumps Again,
Perfect Youth,
and Don Pyle's
Trouble at the Camera Club.
Yeah, so there's been some great books all about that 70s period, and nobody had covered the 80s in a substantial way. Nick Smash had done his book, but it was more post-punk. It wasn't about hardcore punk. And so a bunch of us said, why isn't there a book like that about, you know, 80s hardcore? You know, somebody should do this. And then finally we went, oh, well, we did the fanzines back then. We might as well do this. Like, you
know. And speaking of which, okay, what fanzines did you guys do?
I did Still Thinking. So we did it was a zine and a record label in...
You know, I remember that one. I had a cassette. And it was a cassette with a book, correct? Is that it?
We put out a compilation, like 87, with a bunch of Toronto bands on it. So we never did a cassette and book, but somebody could have taped it for you. So it could have been that.
Oh, I'm thinking of something else. It was some, I corresponded with a handful of people.
Okay.
Out there, and I remember Spencer Mack. I remember getting his tapes.
Yeah, Spencer did a whole tape distribution.
At War with Vivis Sectors, and there was another one, and I can't
Wipeout
remember
tapes,
the name.
I believe.
Yeah, that was Spencer's tape label.
Yeah, there was one. Maybe Still Thinking. I thought that's what it was called, but no, maybe not. It was some fancy booklet that came with a tape.
Oh, okay.
I wish I could remember. That's
are you thinking
now.
Of the Animal Liberation one that Electra?
Yeah, that's it. Yeah.
Yeah, that was Al Hackenberg, who's a tremendous fella,
yeah.
Did a lot for the book, gave us a lot of great photographs and so on. He was responsible.
Okay,
for that.
So you guys all, you said you all did fanzines. Did you guys all know each other back then, I guess you met through the hardcore scene.
We met through the hardcore scene. Like I put out a record with MSI on it. Derek Emerson was in MSI, and he did a number of metal fanzines early on with Glenn Salter. We knew each other, but we weren't good friends back then, but we knew each other.
I remember when you released the Heresy LP, Sean.
Yeah,
I actually remember buying that off you outside a show. Was that 88?
It was 88, yeah.
Yeah, I remember buying that off you at a show. And I did a fanzine called Breach of Discipline that I actually managed to get out of the book and nobody noticed that it was removed, which was great.
Okay.
It's a shame, though, because I was reading Breach of Discipline and the interviews in there are actually very, like, some of the only interviews I've read of some of these bands.
So yeah, I
so
remember
I'm grateful
record,
for it. I'm
so
grateful
it was,
that you did put a Breach of Discipline. I thought felt like it was a great zine.
A footnote at best.
it was about 80. I remember that record when it came out. I believe it was 88 that Heresy record came out. I think I got the UK pressing though. The
okay.
Indian-based press,
you didn't.
Yeah.
So it's your fault basically that it failed.
And okay. So you guys all knew each other back then. That's how you and Simon met, and that's Sean I'm talking to.
Yeah.
Do you remember what was the first hardcore show you went to in Toronto? Like, what was the first what was the first show, like the hardcore show?
I'm trying to remember what my first, like, I know my first concert was Teenage Head opening for Triumph at the CNE in 81, and then my second concert was Devo, and I was more into alternative music. And 84, I started doing interviews for CKLN on a show on there called Exposure, and I started interviewing different alternative bands. So I think my first show was in 84 at Larry's. I can't even remember what it would have been.
For me, it was...
And that's Larry's Hideaway, which I've read about in the book. Little kind of hole in the wall. I heard about it back then. I remember reading about it in a metal magazine called Metallion.
There was a lot of metal there. Like, it was a fancy hotel in the 50s that your parents would have went out to dinner to, and it would have been a fancy night out. By the 70s or 80s, it was down on its luck. It was sort of like a hotel upstairs for lodgers and prostitutes.
And
drug dealers.
That's what I've read about as well. The book goes right. I really like the book, how it talks about these venues and the people that were running them and stuff like that. And I thought it was really cool.
All stories that we didn't know when we were frequenting them. We didn't, you know, you had the feel of the place, but just getting the stories out of the people that ran and owned the clubs.
Derek was actually a prostitute living at Larry's Hideaway and started venturing down to see the bands before turning tricks. That's actually his first show.
He edited that out.
If he doesn't show up for an interview, that's what happens.
He doesn't like being treated as a sex object. But for me, it was DRI, De Kreutzen and Dr. No, which is a show that looms large in that book. I tried to go to a few shows beforehand, but nothing was all ages back then, and I remember going to see JFA shortly before that, and the cops shut down the place because someone had been stabbed at a metal show the night before. But the first show I actually made it into, when all ages shows were not a part of the culture the way they are now, was De Kreutzen, actually, in 86.
Okay, and where was that show at, Simon?
The Ukrainian Hall, I believe it was. Was that the Ukrainian
Hall? Yeah, Ukrainian Hall that was at Spadina and College.
Just got knocked down a couple years ago to make way for condos, believe it or not.
Surprise, surprise.
Yeah. But actually, one of the condos Dr. No lives in, so it's...
I thought those guys lived in California. Was it
they made a lot of money. They were on Metal Blade, dude. They have condos everywhere. But anyways, we digress. Next question,
and how cool of them to open their record with a DOA cover, out of all things, eh?
I didn't know they did.
The Silent Earth?
Oh, that's true, yeah. And there's a great photo of them at Niagara Falls that Jill Heath took in the book. Of them.
Jill Heath, another contributor to the book, or would you say was she actively important in the book too?
She gave us a whole bunch of her photos. I think there was like 60 odd photos from her. And then Steve helped us with a number of the interviews that are going to be on Equalizing Distort as well. And Jill came in for two interviews. So most bands, we did one interview.
And we spoke for about 6 hours with Jill.
Yeah. Jill was crucial to hardcore happening in Toronto, period, the way it did.
Yeah.
So who that? Jill Productions. I read all about her, too.
That's correct.
Yeah.
If you've got she was Canadian records by Articles of Faith and Channel 3 and so on, she released those on her Lone Wolf label as well. She did a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah, and now that I'm enjoying your Instagram, Simon, I read the No Mind review today. Yeah, that's a record that I bought back then that I still quite enjoy. That Tales of Ordinary Madness, Toronto band.
Yep.
Yeah.
And that was on her label Lone Wolf, right?
Yeah.
And so how did it come together? How did what is UXB Press? Who released the Tomorrow Is Too Late?
Everything to do with it is a homage to Direct Action. So UXB was one of their songs. So Unexploded Bomb was a Direct Action song. Tomorrow Is Too Late is a Direct Action song. And then the mythology we're using is that we printed 984 copies of the book, which is a reference to their song 1984. So
neat.
So everything. That's excellent. They were sort of a band that was, you know, they always seemed otherworldly. Like, you know, all the hardcore bands just seemed like guys you knew, but Direct Action seemed different. And you know, I only saw them a couple times before they broke up, but they always had this sort of mystique and mythos around them, whereas...
When other people wore track pants, they were still Discharge meets the Misfits.
Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah.
Did you know them personally, or was that... What was the... What was the mysterious aura about them?
They seemed like a serious band. Like they seemed like, you know, like Simon was saying, they had this Discharge in Toronto sort of feel. Like,
you wouldn't see these guys working at a drive-thru.
Yeah.
I see.
They weren't working at the gas station.
But were they older than you guys?
Yeah, they were all older than us. And like I would have probably seen them on the TV show from City TV, The New Music. Like there was an interview with them that Daniel Richler did. And that would have been... The first time I saw them would have been on TV.
But people also referenced their sound about how heavy they were and how when they first came into Toronto, They were already sort of a complete unit because they were formed out of some of the members of the Unknowns from St. Catharines, which were an earlier punk band. And they two of the members had moved to Toronto and started up Direct Action. And so they had already had a kick at the can playing in a punk band. And then when hardcore came along, they
kicked it up a notch. You can want to tell your it's kind of like the way story.
It's a bit like the way Teenage Head is described as well. Right?
Yeah.
Teenage Head were already a practicing band before punk sort of comes along, and at least for a couple of years in their basement. And then when finally they get a chance to play, they'd blow everyone away.
My friend Greg was
living with at least a couple of those guys, and he says that they were buying a lot of records, and they were clued into things. They were buying Minor Threat and Discharge records earlier than other people were, and it was influencing their music. And but I mean, in real time as it was happening. So when you look back, maybe now, you look at the whole world, and there were quite a few bands that sounded like that, but there weren't yet in Toronto. And there's always some. You're always going to stick in people's memories more and hold more influence when you were the first to do something somewhere in a big city that would become something much bigger later.
Yeah.
So UXB Press is just for the book, nothing more type thing.
We're going to do some more things with it. We put on a live show with five bands that are on the 7-inch and that are in the book as part of that. So we're going to continue to work with Simon's Ugly Pop Records and put some things out. We're working next on a metal book.
And it should also be noted that there was a fine 11-song 7-inch with the book.
Yeah.
It's actually a 7.5-inch, if you look. A lot of people don't notice that. It's a little bigger than the average record because we were originally going to put 10 songs on it. We decided we want an 11th song, so we have to make it a little wider.
Yeah. And maybe some of those bands, maybe their amps go to 11.
There you go.
They did.
Yeah.
They did.
I've heard quite a few songs on your show, actually.
Yeah,
it's been getting a lot of airtime on Generation Annihilation.
Yeah, and I haven't played it all yet, so
I've
saved a few. I actually haven't cheated and played the whole side of the record either,
true.
Six songs one side. And so let's talk about some of the bands who are on the record. The Angry Thalidomide Babies, that's Sons of Ishmael. That's Tim Freeborn, is it? Or and some of the Sons of Ishmael, or...?
I'm trying to remember who else. You've got the sheet.
But we should say that Tim's efforts in this project shouldn't be also recognized.
Oh yeah,
Tim was a big mover in this.
Tim would dance naked for us when our morale flagged.
Tim would give a transcribing.
Even more importantly, he transcribed Steve would do these. We called
6-hour interviews.
We called him the Brian Linehan of punk rock, where he would grill bands for 5-6 hours. For the book, and Tim ended up transcribing the majority of those big interviews. So.
Yeah, he's an expert proofreader and copy editor for sure.
Yeah.
Nice, Tim Freeborn. Yeah, I used to write him. He was from. He actually lived in Meaford, Ontario.
That's
when Sons of Ishmael were still around. So yeah, I guess they relocated to Toronto and.
Do you remember how the beginning of the record, the first record, goes?
The Sons of Ishmael.
Welcome to Meaford. Yuck.
You have to.
Got that one.
Hello there, Cousin Clem. Welcome to Meaford. Yuck.
Cousin Clem.
God damn them punk rockers.
No.
Come
Cousin
on,
Clem.
Aaron.
What's that horrible noise?
Oh, God, I'm shamed. Yes. Yes.
Well, hello there. Welcome to Meaford. Yuck. Yuck.
Cousin Clem, what's that horrible noise?
Bad gum, them punk rockers.
Are you considering a master's degree? Launch your career with a master's in digital media. It's co-offered by UBC, SFU, Emily Carr, and BCIT, and you get to work with the industry to learn essential collaboration, leadership, and teamwork skills while building digital media products. Learn more about this at an online webinar on December 6th For more information, visit thecdm.ca. That is thecdm.ca.
All right, a track from the fine Sons of Ishmael Hayseed Hardcore 7-inch, later released on a 12-inch on Schizophrenic Records, and it was repressed a couple of times in my pressing's from 87, the 7-inch, and I think it originally came out in 85, 86, and it was quite popular after being reviewed by Pusshead, John, Brian Schroeder in Thrasher Magazine. And for those of you just tuned in, we are conducting an interview which took place last week at CIUT with the a few of the coordinators of the Toronto Is Too Late hardcore book, ginormous book, all about the Toronto scene in the early to mid-80s. So let's get back into that interview. Here we go. Oops, my bad. Let's get back into that interview right here. Here we go.
Osmort,
yeah, right? And they were the headliners of the show that we did for the launch show back on October 13th, and you know, we had guys flying in from all over, from, you know, Calgary, Vancouver, or Victoria rather, just to play the show. And then Mitch, the original singer from Sudden Impact, flew in from California just to get up on stage and do Sudden Impact, the song Sudden Impact with Sudden Impact. So yeah, we had people flying in from all over just to be there for the launch and to connect with the old hardcore scene.
And so who played the gig?
So the headliner was Negative Gain. They were the headliner for it. Sudden Impact was there.
Micro Edge,
who, another great band who did an amazing demo and never had it. All, and everything that's on that record was never on vinyl ever before. It was all stuff that was on cassette releases, mostly, you know.
Yeah.
More than half of them were things that Brian Taylor had released, but they were never on vinyl.
Chronic Submission.
Brian Taylor from Youth,
yeah,
who ran the record peddler. And
Diabolic, yeah, Force and the Arc Rock, the radio show here at CKLN in Toronto.
Such a huge figure in the scene.
Yeah.
So Chronic Submission was another one of the big ones.
And they slayed me at that show. They were so great. And they've gotten back together. Like, they've been together for about 5 years now, but they haven't played that often.
Yeah.
But,
we're talking about Chronic Submission?
Yeah.
And everyone talked about this story about, because they were so young when they were got in the scene. They were like they were 12 to 14 year olds when they were first getting into the hardcore scene. And, you know, they were kind of treated like a novelty act, right? They were, here's the little kids, kind of the punk rock little kids, right? And then they get up on stage and blow people away. And it was the same, like, everyone talked about that story. And then I witnessed it at that book launch, because they just,
they
destroyed it. It was just insane. But then every band, you know, upped the ante after playing. Like, I mean, the Sudden Impact got on after them and then destroyed. And then, like, Micro Edge did the same thing, and Negative Gain. They were just like, it was just one after the other. It, like, usually, yeah, with these reunion shows, you know, it's awful, right? You get up there, these bands get up there, and they're not that good. They're not as good as they used to be. That wasn't the case for any of these bands. It was insane, actually.
Yeah.
I saw some footage from Youth, some years back.
That's 2009.
You couldn't get, hard to believe, that was almost 10 years ago, but you couldn't get them to play, or?
Brian had toyed with the idea and had tried to, we had asked anybody we had interviewed, we'd asked them about interest, so everybody thought about it, Direct Action had thought about it, but I think
if they could, they would have, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, cool.
And Chronic, we should also mention that Chronic Submission, there's just a collection of their stuff just came out on Schizophrenic Records. So it was like not only just a book launch, but it was also their record release party.
Yeah, so that, yeah, the record release party for that, and then
for Empty Heads, Poison Darts, which is a second.
Yeah, which was a cassette that never made it out and on vinyl, and then MSI, a bunch of their unrecorded stuff got released at that show as well, too.
And also,
there's a new MSI. MSI stands for More Stupid Initials.
Initials, yeah. And they had another release on Schizophrenic of all their released and unreleased stuff. So,
and that's out now, or?
Yep.
And one of the stories about Chronic Submission was that Jello was interested in putting them out. He had actually written them, offered them to release a record by them.
And Metal Blade.
And Metal Blade too, yeah.
And
okay, and how long did this entire project take?
It took over 2 years. It took about 2 years and a few months, I think. Derek and I remember the date. It was September 11th, 2 years ago, So it took us from that until October 13th of this year to pull it all together. And, you know, Simon was very much involved in the upfront pieces. We all sort of planned, you know, what's the ideal bands that we should interview. I think we covered everybody that we could. We probably did the bigger bands and more important bands in depth than some of the bands that lasted for shorter periods or that were from the later periods. So it really
was it hard to track anybody down from the old Toronto scene there?
There was a handful of people we didn't get, and there was only ever a handful of people that said, I don't want to be involved. I'd say 98% of the people we approached were all very keen and receptive and open. And, you know, we interviewed, I'd say, probably about 150, 175 people in the end, including full bands. So Steve would interview, four or five band members or three band members. And then we had about 50 people give us their photo and flyer collection. So it was a year. Derek, I think, lived over a scanner for a year.
I think for Derek has a very responsible adult 40-hour week office job, and this was like having another job for him. I mean, it shows up in the quality of the work, but it's really something else to see the sheer amount of time and effort that was put into this by Derek and Sean.
And I want to say one other thing, Aaron. I feel like there's something that Sean was talking about and Simon were talking about with the history of Toronto punk being somewhat, getting somewhat documented. And it was great reading all these pieces, but they didn't speak to my reality. And I think they didn't speak to a lot of the people's reality who grew up in that hardcore era. And this was sort of a way to get that recorded and in some ways, recognize that they were here. Like that wasn't the reality. The reality that I was reading about in those punk books were not the reality that I lived. And there was much more to it. And it was exciting in a different way for me. And I feel like this was a way of capturing that legacy, the legacy of a lot of these people and like just so much scene building that had gone on. And there were so many different things that had happened. And I mean, the book only touches when you talk to Sean about how much stuff was left on the editing floor. It was like only a tenth of it got into the book,
A tenth of the written and maybe 6% of the visuals made it into
and
the book.
And it's still a 300-plus page book, right?
Books about punk tend to cover specific slivers of the scene. There's very rarely an overview of the entire thing. And, I mean, there's different scenes in Toronto, different realities, and each of them is valid. I mean, you could be a straight-edge skateboarding, record-collecting teenage nerd in the suburbs, or you could be a PCP-smoking, like, gutter punk, Kendon Market type, And you were both experiencing punk in your own way in the 80s. Obviously, the former is way cooler than the latter, but they both happened.
Yeah, totally.
So
one band that I noticed wasn't in, maybe they are, maybe I just didn't come across them yet, Random Killing, are they?
They're in there, yeah. And they're still going today. They're one of those bands that has gone forever, and they're in there. We covered some, we couldn't cover everybody, but we covered at least, the more significant bands, and they were in there.
I want to say they're the only band in there that signed to a major label.
Okay, that's interesting. That's true, I knew they did sign to A&M Records.
That's right, yeah. And we talked about that earlier and then thought, no, they were just distributed by A&M. But I went and I looked, and no, they actually were on A&M Records.
Yeah. So, they had CDs out. I don't remember, back then CDs were the thing, right?
Yeah.
In the early 90s. That's a lot of new releases were coming out on CD. But yeah, I remember that.
Them and the Diodes.
Them and the Diodes.
There's an idea that I've come to a couple times with this. If you look in this book, I mean, we have some of the ones. There's no clear lines with this stuff, and there shouldn't be, about what's a hardcore band or not or whatever. I mean, obviously, some things suggest themselves much more easily than others. But we talk about these parallel scenes that absolutely overlapped. The main thrust of that would have been the metal thrash stuff, which came around about 83, 84, that was metal that was essentially influenced by punk. And it wasn't hardcore. Some of it, there's the whole crossover where the lines get really blurry. It needed to be mentioned. We didn't go too far into it. And the same with a lot of the more 60s-rooted, garagey kind of bands that were definitely small-p punk bands. And a lot of them played shows with hardcore bands. It was, So that stuff gets a mention, but it doesn't get concentrated on. However, what we do talk about, I think, the philosophy with this book is not hardcore simply being three chords super fast by people with shaven heads, but hardcore may be interpreted more culturally than sonically. So hardcore meaning punk that wasn't new wave. Punk of the 80s that was a variety of different styles and approaches and philosophies represented, but all that was squarely punk music that was not, you know, power pop or new wave music.
Yeah,
and that's partially because that book, Alone and Gone, had come out, and it's covered part of that, right?
Yeah, Nick Smash's book. And, you know, and in the beginning, in the early 80s, the post-punk stuff was all together, so you were seeing ska bands with hardcore bands with, you know, maybe some early metal stuff or a reggae band. But then by, like, 83, 84, hardcore and punk get sort of pushed out of that Queen West alternative music scene and sort of lives on its own. And a lot of bands played in the same venues, like, you know, Larry's is a prime example of where metal and hardcore were living together. But by the time, you know, when we were at, you know, the biggest club of our area was the Bridge or / Ildico / Starwood. And, you know, lots of bands were playing there, like Neon Rome or Fifth Column, things like that were there. So we cover some of those bands just simply because they were all sort of connected scenes. But, we, you know, the Queen West scene pushed punk out fairly early on, or we left. I'm not sure which of the two.
If you were going to go see Direct Action, you were going to see Slaughter or Razor. If you were going to go see No Means No play Toronto, there's a good chance that you'd see the Woods of the Lawn opening or something. You know, if you were going to see any kind of diverse range of bands within the broader rubric of punk, you were going to be exposed to other interesting, energetic music in Toronto. And there's much more to be said about this. Obviously, you could write 100 books.
And when would you say that the hardcore scene kind of died down? Do you think it just kept thriving, or do you think it died down, came up in waves, or would you?
I think it went in waves. I think from my experience, I think after the Bridge closed, I think it died. I think you know, Larry's and the DMZ and the Bridge provided homes for punk, and then when the Bridge or Ildico's closed, shows started happening along the Spadina corridor, the College Street corridor, but they didn't feel like home anymore to me. Like, there was punk shows there, but it felt like it lost its way. But I'm sure people who were part of the earlier 80s hardcore scene said it died by 84, you know, and by the time stuff was happening at the DMZ, people would said, oh, it's dead.
The music changed too. I mean, you know, you got like emo and metal crossover. I mean, there wasn't really any hardcore after about 1988-89. I mean, it just became metal, and I mean, like, you know, at that point people just started calling short-haired metal bands hardcore bands, and that defined the 90s, but it, you know, it was terrible. And
I cut you off, Simon. I'm sorry. You're done?
Well, go ahead.
Okay. What would you say the scene is like now versus then? Bigger. Obviously there's not... Are there still, there's a big thing on fanzines, there's a big thing on record stores. How are the record stores and the fanzine scene?
Record stores, there's one punk record store. I mean, this is way too much of a conversation to get into about record stores because the entire cultural climate has changed on that in a way that defies being summed up, I think. I mean, there's a million different issues.
Right. So
one thing that we did speak about is that there's millions of great bands in Toronto right now, all kinds. Yeah. You look right at the end there, at the end of the book, I mean, there was a very specific desire not to be one of these books that treats punk as something that died the moment, whatever. Yeah. So there's three bands at the end there, which is Shit, Victim Party, and Career Suicide. And all of them are quite different from one another. If you want a reference point, Shit is Discharge, Career Suicide is Minor Threat, Victim Party is Dillinger 4. You know, but they're all kind of like DIY, really good, recent Toronto punk bands. So this stuff is still happening. But it's huge. I mean, we've got a great scene. Having said that, one thing that's come up, and I've spoken to younger kids into hardcore here, there isn't a fanzine in Toronto, which is wild. You know,
About Equalizing? Does Steve still do the newsletter?
No, that I haven't been doing that for a while.
Okay.
Yeah, but you're recording the bands, and like that's probably the closest thing to.
But there's no kids putting out consistently a print fanzine.
Yeah.
That is something that is over. And we spoke about at the beginning of this interview how we all met was we all did hardcore fanzines. I mean, fanzines were the lingua franca of hardcore. That's how people communicated and spoke. And the internet it's so trite. The internet changed everything. But I mean, really, the internet took over as a new way of connecting people that essentially made fanzines a luxury. I mean, there's people who, I mean, I count myself as one of these people. I still want to hold and own tangible items. I think that is much more enduring. But in terms of being a sort of a instant means of communicating quick ideas, fanzines have been replaced by tweets.
Tweets and Instagrams. And people are still buying their Maximum Rock and Roll. Like, you
not
know.
Really.
No, though. You're not finding it?
No, that's no. It's basically done.
Yeah.
You know, I find now that I can you know, Maximum Rock and Roll once had its place to show these scene reports and these bands, and you write to these bands. But now we have Bandcamp. You can just Google up any genre, and it's all there for you. And I guess it's in some ways in a good thing, but some ways the cultural aesthetic has been taken over, been replaced. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, so is the book is sold out now? Is that correct?
We're looking at doing a second printing of it, but we did, as I said, the 984 copies. Some of them, the first run came with the 7-inch. We will likely not put the 7-inch out again. But you know, what we're looking to see if there's some other opportunities to re-release some stuff from that period as well. With UXB and Ugly Pop, so we'll keep people posted on that.
What I want to say, though, is I had said a minute ago about, because this is something I do think needs to be spoken about the difference between now and then, as I said that we used to have these different scenes and that fanzines kind of enabled people to speak between one another from different scenes. Yeah. They connected people back then. And as you just said, you can Google up a genre on Bandcamp. So I don't know if that's entirely healthy because it doesn't facilitate that kind of broadening of horizons or so on the way fanzines did. But anyway, Sorry, that's...
And also shows, like accidental seeing other bands, right?
Yeah.
You sort of come across bands by going to a show.
Well, I mean, I used to have like John Truby and the Ugly Janitors of America records because I would go into a record peddler to buy, you know, Discharge and Negative Gain records or whatever.
And
you'd find them
right?
Crazy weird. Because like it says in the book, you'd say, where's the alternative section? Before that was a dirty word. I mean, you know, now we think of that as like Pearl Jam and Nirvana and stuff. But back then, you know, alternative was the broader punk.
Yeah, for sure.
And so underground music. And you could stumble upon other things because everything wasn't tidily stuck into little categories for you. And that was healthy.
Right. Okay, well, those are my questions, guys. Thanks a lot. Check out the book. Tomorrow is too late. Second press. Any chance of it hitting bookstores or just online or?
We were selling it through distributors, so 20 copies made its way out to Vancouver, but they sold out.
Josh Nickel had them, but they sold out in a day. I will probably try and twist his arm into purchasing more for you people.
Excellent.
Not that Vancouver deserves it. You know, you guys have always been Canada's second city in punk rock.
Right, where does Montreal come in your
1.5? Sorry, yeah, you guys are third.
Oh, okay. Okay, then.
Actually, Victoria's cooler than Vancouver.
Right. Cool. Okay, thanks a lot, guys.
Take care.
Thank you.
Bye.
Cheers.
All right, that was my interview I did last week with about the book Tomorrow is Too Late with three of the book's fine contributors, Simon Harvey, Steve Perry, and Sean Cherry. So there you go. We're going to try and cram some more blasts of Toronto hardcore in, starting before Power Chord, and this is a Chronic Submission. Here we go.
So you think you're hardcore, eh?
Fucking air anymore, there's something wrong. Like a bad looking ball, why six alone? It's great, I'm fucking a white.
All right, winding up another edition of Generation Annihilation. Started things all off with, where did we start? We started with Chronic Submission, Whose Right Is It from the Sick of Reality demo. Heard two tracks from the Fine, Tomorrow Is Too Late compilation. Actually, three tracks. We heard two tracks by Micro Edge, So You Think You're Hardcore, A, and Second Last. And we heard from Sudden Impact with a track called Cat's Life. Sudden Impact had two albums out in the 80s. That was from a demo of theirs that was featured on the Tomorrow's Too Late compilation EP, which came with the Fine book. Followed with MSI, More Stupid Initials, the generic straight edge song from their first 7-inch. They had two back in the day. We followed with the Nunfuckers, another act who had a 7-inch that I heard way back when as well. Came around in the same era. They were from Kitchener-Waterloo. Dead and on the Floor was the name of the track. We had a track called Decimation. And then we heard a few modern Toronto hardcore bands. We heard from Career Suicide from the Machine Response release on Deranged Records. We heard a track called Distraction, Career Suicide, going since the early 2000s. And we heard from Tash Me, probably the most recent acts on the show. We heard a track called Where You Fall is from their self-titled 7-inch. And from Shit, from the What You Stand For EP, we heard a track called Algorithm. So yeah, I hope you enjoyed the spotlight on Toronto Hardcore. We're going to leave you with one more track. This is Slaughter, kind of an act on the metal side. And yeah, they were Toronto's answer to Celtic Frost, as far as I'm concerned. And in other ways, we had Witch's Hammer, they had Slaughter, a band that would play with all the hardcore bands back then. Check our playlists and podcasts online, www.generationannihilation.com. Like us on Facebook. Stay tuned for Power Chord up next.